Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and permanently archived at alexlinder.com in time. Now, today we're going to do a briefer one. We're going to do Appendix 10, and it's about 10 pages, so probably maybe 20, 30 minutes. Chapter 10, James Mason Siege, Appendix 1, Address. What follows is the text of an address given to a meeting of Tom Metzger's White Aryan Resistance by James Mason on December 15, 1986, delivered from Chillicothe, Ohio, 01110, to San Diego, California, through the medium of long-distance telephone attached to loudspeakers. 10.1. Betrayal. Quote, I'm sure Tom Metzger doesn't turn his audiences over to any guest speaker without at least some form of prior introduction. While he and I have not met, Tom Metzger and I have become acquainted over the past 10 years, that is, during the period just past, when the movement that we are both part of was basically lost and searching to find itself. I'm sure all of you there in California are well aware of the tremendous job Tom Metzger has done on behalf of the movement in his dealings with the masses of people through the media and in the electorate. There will never be a replacement for the ability to reach people and move people in great numbers, and if a history of the movement were to be written today, Tom Metzger would be found among the top half dozen or so over the past 20 years in the area of reaching and leading and organizing people. That is why I didn't hesitate when he invited me to address this gathering of his today through this unique method. What I'm about to tell you will probably have more meaning for many of you if I first provide some information on my own background, as very seldom has any of it appeared in any public medium. For the past 5 years, I have been editing and publishing a newsletter which is entitled Siege, and that is how most people active in the movement today know me. Next year, 1986, will mark my 20th year as part of this movement as an active and full-time member. I like to think of Siege as being representative of everything I've seen, heard, experienced, felt, and thought over the past 20 years. Unlike so many of the older so-called professional right-wingers of the 50s and 60s, whose philosophical and editorial line never changed one iota amidst the most radical and dramatic national changes around them, the content of Siege today would bear no resemblance to what I was thinking and writing 20 years ago. I would like to view this fact as a genuine learning and maturing process, as well as keeping in step with the reality of the times. My start with the movement came with a bang when, at the age of 14, I joined the National Socialist Youth Movement, which was the young people's part of the American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell. This is not to say that I skipped the usual conservative preparatory phase which most of us go through. I well remember the day my father took me out of my classes at school so that we both could go together to see Richard Nixon when, in 1960, he made a whistle stop here in Chillicothe as part of his first presidential campaign. I remember 4 years later getting out of class on my own so that I could return to the same spot by the tracks and help welcome Barry Goldwater during his own campaign. And finally, 4 years later, I was a backer of George Wallace. It was the last time I ever took a serious interest in mainstream party politics. You must by now get an idea of my early background. By 1968, however, my education as a radical was beginning to take root. That was the year I turned my back on everything connected with the system. That was the year I left school, left home, left Ohio, and traveled to what was party headquarters at that time, Arlington, Virginia. I was 16 then. Commander Rockwell had been dead just over 1 year, but the party was still firmly committed to carrying out his strategies of defending, as he called it, the white Christian constitutional republic of America. It was the time when vast, numberless armies of blacks, Jews, and brainwashed whites, totally lost to their race, would rally in Washington, D.C., directly across the river from us, in support of every cause from civil rights to victory for the Viet Cong. And since there was no other opposition to them in evidence, we took it upon ourselves to face the task of, as we perceived it, defending the nation's honor against traitors, standing up for the white race itself, and, hopefully, as a byproduct of this, inspiring some of our own people to wake up and take a stand with us. At the best of times, there were 50 to 100 of us. Mostly we numbered only a couple dozen. Then, too, were the after-hours and unofficial, out-of-uniform night rides when we numbered from 4 to 6, during which we disrupted our share of communist and assorted left-wing gatherings. A legend was made, and a lot of fun and adventure was had, all against odds that are pointless to bring up. But nothing changed. Or did it? The 70s witnessed the final betrayal in Vietnam, something unthinkable in the 60s. The 70s also witnessed the final betrayal of white Americans and the handing over to blacks of everything and more that had been arrogantly demanded in the 60s when the major riots had erupted. And the 70s saw the breakup of the old traditional forms of political arrangement within the movement. For my part, the party was no more, and throughout the 70s was reduced to a half dozen or so squabbling factions. Probably most of the rest of you have experienced the same thing. It was a time of great bitterness and disillusionment all around. Just when all of the evils predicted by Commander Rockwell as early as 1960 were coming to pass, the organization he had founded and built up to answer the crisis was laying in pieces. Excuses and recriminations aside, the cause for it all was betrayal. In Commander Rockwell's lifetime, it was not at all unreasonable to plan for the action of a spearhead movement to prompt the loyal elements within the established government to wake up and take things back away from the nation's subverters. And you may remember that so great a man as Revelo Oliver, who was on the John Birch Society and who worked for the government OSS during the war, thought that after the war, forces of would come to D.C. and just clean it out. And he later realized he was naive, but that's what he thought. So that apparently Rockwell felt something of the same thing, that the loyal elements within the established government would wake up and take things away from the subverters. Mason again. Since his death, and in plain fact, things have moved way beyond that stage. What this means to us as a movement is that any kind of fascist-style coup d'etat is completely out of the question, as the basis for it just doesn't exist. Nothing and no one in government, and I include business, high finance, and the military, could be considered remotely as being American in the traditional sense, the way Commander Rockwell and any old-style patriot understood it. Those of them who would bother to protest this isn't true are merely pledging their allegiance to the perverted and degenerate concept of America as it is presently being defined by this country's subverters from their now supreme position of power and influence. And that, my friends, means that there no longer is a real and valid concept of America. It has succumbed to total betrayal. And one of those movements and parties designated and designed and created in the 50s and 60s to combat that which has indeed already come to pass. They, after having been betrayed by what some within the movement would term majority elements within the establishment, thus rendering their entire premise and reason for being as utterly futile, were, in turn, betrayed by their own leaders. Sold out. The courage, the vision, the honesty, and the guts were not present in the existing leadership at that time to take what was, by today's standard, a comparatively large radical body of people, already committed and having sacrificed a great deal, and carefully, in a professional and controlled manner, turning them from the thoughts and ways of reaction to those of revolution. But, almost as a hallmark for the way everything else that is to come in the future for this struggle, this betrayal, too, had to be total. From direct personal experience, I want to assure all of you that nothing is ever broken finally or severed completely. Nothing is ever a waste of time unless you, yourself, become so disillusioned that you quit. And even then, the waste is confined to just you. Today, our greatest sources of revolutionary guidance and inspiration still are Commander Rockwell and Adolf Hitler. Most, if not all, of the best revolutionary leaders we have today come straight out of the old reactionary movement of years ago. People like Tom Metzger and myself, who back then were contented to pay attention and do our jobs as they were defined for us. Hitler himself admitted in total exasperation at the start of his career that he was doing what he was doing only because no one else was doing it. As far as we are concerned today, we are certain that we can't possibly do a worse job of it than our predecessors. In attempting to define some of the basic differences between a reactionary approach and a revolutionary approach to any struggle or challenge, it would be best to deal strictly with how the individual must view things around him. Because if the individual isn't properly trained and educated, isn't properly indoctrinated and motivated, then he or she is no more than a prime target for disillusionment and betrayal. Leaders can fail or deliberately mislead. Before anything resembling a revolutionary organization can be built, all the people involved, high and low, must be inculcated with a revolutionary spark within their conscious minds so that they cannot be led astray, so that they cannot be disillusioned or confused, and most of all, so that they each can serve as revolutionary leaders themselves for the day when action of a truly massive scale arrives. The idea implanted by the reactionaries in years past was never. The idea we must implant in the minds of all of our people today is why not? The attitude of never was a purely defensive one, and defensive in the hands of those who had already been struck defenseless, morally and ideologically. Never mind the weapons in the hands of Americans from the H-bomb down to private pistols. It was never an issue of that. When the system forces won the Second World War, and the nations of the West joined to destroy Germany, and particularly what Germany stood for, they in effect committed suicide. What the system had persuaded Americans to destroy by means of open warfare in Central Europe left wide open for more subtle, gradual assault at home, those very things that had made this country what it was and had safeguarded it for the future. Racism and the freedom to be what you are and to take measures to protect your future. When the right wing said never, the system responded with, eventually. The revolutionary in the midst of today's world, even with no background in the right wing, should take a long look at himself and ask, why not? On the basis of what this democracy is supposed to be all about, why not give full status to every non-white? According to the values that exist, why not accept as equal anything that passes for human if he can compete with you in the same rat race? If money is the goal and pleasure is the end, what is the real difference between blacks and whites? How can anyone dare discriminate, and for what possible purpose other than bigotry and prejudice? The answer is very plain. It is impossible. Of course, you and I know that what passes today for whites are a far cry from what whites were and should be. And you and I know that this has come about through no accident. But as revolutionaries, this is of little concern to us. As right-wingers, it was everything. It points up a problem, but it provides no answers. Right-wingers would never have discussed the idea of their own revolution. That was what the communists were up to, and they are the enemy, right? But the decisions and the policies and the actions that have destroyed this country did not emanate from Moscow. The revolutionary would ask himself, why not a revolution of our own, right here? With no order at all, with absolute chaos for a time, even with large chunks of the political geography breaking away on their own, could things possibly be worse for our people? The right-wingers were totally occupied with this or that little detail of encroaching rot, while altogether hypnotized by the specter of communism. The revolutionary is concerned with shutting off the source of the poison. And that source is this system, this government, this very society itself, inhaling and exhaling its own poisons in the form of its thoroughly rotted morals and values. Even if you cannot get your mind away from coloreds and communists, etc., by now you should have been asking yourself, what greater friend in this world do they both have than the U.S. federal government? What has always prevented the people from cleaning up their own mess, if not the government and its spies and police? And beyond that, you should have become aware by now that the masses of whites have long since become so conditioned and so rotten that they cannot be expected to somehow miraculously wake up and join with us. It's been effectively tried and ample opportunities have come. It's not going to work. At the very end, however, is the fact that we do not and should not want any part, large or small, of this current situation. It is unsalvageable, and we would be quite foolish to want to share in its fall. Rather, we want to be part of the hastening of its fall, and the sooner the better. I'm confident that enough of the revolutionary qualities and capabilities of Tom Metzger to believe that, so far, I've not gone over the heads of anyone in what I've been outlining and calling for. So far, this is where practically all of us have led up to. The next barrier that has to be broken, and I might add the final one, is what to do. In the pages of Siege, I beg the readers not to go out and do something stupid that will get them locked up or killed. Our numbers are too small and our people are too valuable to waste in senseless acts of suicide. It is not a matter of advocating legality or illegality. As revolutionaries, our only compulsion is circumstances. Once a proper revolutionary course has been set, if the system's law gets in the way, then it must be either circumvented or violated directly. But I emphasize circumvention at present as the only effective way of leading up to a viable, successful revolt from our quarter. What I advocate is doing only what you have to do and doing it in a manner that will leave you untouched by system hands. In our struggle today, there are no rewards and no penalties, only consequences. You can start by defending yourself against the system full time, where you live, where it counts. Right-wingers would attend a gathering or a demonstration and then go home, back to being an integral part of the system. Meeting, eating, and retreating. That's a favorite phrase of Tom Metzger's. I don't know if he invented it. Eat, meet, and retreat. Or show, blow, and go. Usually their families had no respect either for them or their beliefs. Usually they struggled hard just to survive at the bottom rung of the system's economic ladder. A revolutionary doesn't place it in a headquarters building or a meeting hall or a membership card or a uniform. He has it within himself, and he has it at home, and it includes everyone that he touches, to a greater or lesser degree, whether they know it themselves or not. Right-wingism is a lot of hogwash that nobody is buying anymore because things have already gone too far. Revolution is like a vapor that can travel under locked doors, through walls, undetected, with no effective defense against it. Revolution is a germ that attacks the bloodstream and organs of a rotten society and government and causes it to collapse, where otherwise it might linger on for generations, thus taking down with it the last thing worth saving, the gene pool from which something new might be created. The eye of the tiger is the mark of the master of any situation. Hitler in Mein Kampf said that it would be with mathematical certainty those who ruthlessly employed revolutionary tactics would emerge the winners. Never forget that it is not the eye of the tiger, but the look of the lost, of the doomed, of the already dead, that is shared by the system, the establishment, and the right wing in common. Metzger is more of a leftist than a rightist, like most racialists are. And he actually even tends to blame white sellouts or traitors more than Jews. So he's a little unusual. The eye of the tiger is found only with those who are lean and hungry, who have no place to go but upward, who have faced death and made themselves fearless. But direct violent attacks against the system right now are useless. You do not go directly from right-wing do-nothingism into equally right-wing bonsai charges. You get ready. You make the change. You sharpen your mind, your wits, and your body. And you do this by defending yourself and your family against system ripoffs and encroachments. For me to become specific at this point would be dangerous for us all. None of you are stupid, I hope, and with a little thought on the matter, you'll all arrive at the proper conclusions and devise the appropriate solutions. Talk, idle talk, is the great killer. Avoid it. Silently make your plan, silently carry it out, and silently remain ever after. At the defensive stage, groups are not called for, and thus leaks are ruled out. Once you have become fully engaged in effectively defending yourself against the system, in effect isolating yourself and insulating yourself from it, you will have found out that a very great many outright illegalities have been undertaken and mastered by you in the course. You will have grown accustomed to living outside of the system's rules, and you will be comfortable with it, knowing that the muscle-bound bureaucracy most certainly does not have eyes in the back of its head. The shift over to the offensive will come naturally and gradually, and, again, we will all be feeling quite relaxed and at home in our new role. A desperate, terrified, and cut-off person with the full weight of the system upon him does not a good revolutionary make. But hundreds of silent dropouts, if you will, no longer having life drain from them to the system, but from the system to them, quiet for the moment, undetected and untouched, make a revolution in themselves. If there is another way of recruiting and training a revolutionary army in this country at this time, then I don't know what it may be. It's no longer a question of making a person read the right political tract or of hating the right segment of the population. People aren't buying into that crap anymore. If there is to be any identifying with the great masses of people, then it is going to be done on the economic level. Make sure everyone you talk with is made aware of precisely who and what the enemy is, the government and the system itself. Counsel them to rid themselves of dead and dried-out notions from the past that today only serve to hold them in economic chains. Point them in the right direction, but don't go so far as to open yourself up for legal consequences from the system. Be a friend to them where you can, so as to better put forth your influence, but don't allow anyone to drag you down. All confusion and conflicts of ideas vanish before the issue of economic survival, without running the risk of alienating anyone, of getting yourself branded as a nut, etc. You can win the minds of practically all of the common people. In this way, an old and confirmed Nazi can effectively make a revolutionary convert out of a liberal humanitarian race mixer. If there is another way of generating a mass movement in this place and time, I do not know what it is. It is my own firm conviction that the economy is the entire key. We must become experts in this area. Not economists, certainly, but masters when it comes to the art of expropriating the expropriators, to borrow something familiar. It is the way to win the minds of the people and to tear down the power of the system. It is the way to be in a controlling position over all of this. At the same stroke, this knocks out all the glorified clowning that has attended all movement attempts in the past. This is very serious, if unglamorous, business. And once we have fully adopted a stance such as this, let them in their controlled media try to poke fun at us or make the people hate us unreasonably. to destroy the system is primary. To destroy the system without destroying ourselves is desirable. But with the system destroyed, a new age of man can begin, one that can contain true justice and equitable solutions for all people. The movement has always possessed sheaves of programs and ideas for building the ideal state, but until the system is destroyed, by whatever means necessary, none of these fine plans will ever amount to anything more than a dream. And that's the end of James Mason's address to Tom Metzger's group back in the mid-80s. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll pick up another one of the 3, 4, 5 appendices that are at the end of Siege.